another home run in your life.
Fly ball deep left center. Grissom.
Ball game over.
In baseball, there's one player who has the privilege of seeing the game unfold in front of him, gets to see each opposing player close enough to have a chat, and an umpire close enough to smell his aftershave. The catcher is to a baseball team as a drummer is to a band. He is the timekeeper, the backbone. He is the man who is behind the curtain and on stage at the same time. Catchers are students of the game. Hall of Famer Gary Carter was one of the greatest to ever play the position. Called the kid by his teammates because he was the cheerleader on the team, always hamming it up for the fans. He played with passion and positivity. He never gave up when it came to baseball. He was a serious competitor. In 2011, when faced with the biggest adversity of his life, he held the same attitude and never gave up. Gary Carter was a love letter to baseball. I'm Nina Instead, and this is Deadball. On April 8, 1954, Gary Edmund Carter was born in Culver City, California, to James H. Carter and his wife, Inga. During World War II, James Carter, a technically inclined man from Kentucky, emigrated to California to work in Hollywood. He was employed by the Hughes Aircraft Company as an aviation parts inspector when Gary was born. Gary's mother, a champion swimmer, was often who Gary attributed his athletic ability to. His mother immigrated to the United States from Germany with her parents in the 1920s. Carter showed great athletic prowess early in life when he became the National Football League's first punt, pass, and kick champion at 7 years of age. In high school, Carter was a three-sport letterman. He was captain of the football, basketball, and baseball teams, and excelled in the classroom, which earned him a spot in the National Honor Society. As Rod Stewart sang, "Some guys have all the luck." The stars aligned for Carter to play football collegiately, and he was a quarterback with all the tools. He received over 100 scholarship offers and signed a letter of intent to play for UCLA. But torn ligaments in his senior year changed those plans. Instead, he switched his focus to baseball. I'm not sure that life as a catcher was the best decision for his knees, but it seemed to work out pretty well. In the 1972 amateur draft, Carter was selected by the Montreal Expos in the third round. At 6'2" and over 220 pounds, Carter's frame was the archetype of a catcher. In 1972, Carter competed in the Rookie League and Class A before moving on to Double A in 1973. He received his first promotion to Triple A at the end of 73. His days in the minors were short-lived. On September 16, 1974, Carter made his debut for the Montreal Expos in a game against the New York Mets. He did not have the greatest of first games, going 0-for-4 against Randy Sterling and Tug McGraw. Carter played 9 games that year with 29 plate appearances and posted a .407 batting average. Carter made his presence known overall that season. In 1975, Carter played both outfield and catcher. He made his first All-Star game that season, coming in as a defensive replacement in the 9th inning, and caught Rod Carew's fly ball for the final out. His slash line was .270, .360, and .416. He was named Sporting News Rookie of the Year and a member of the Topps All-Star Rookie Team. In his second year, Carter came in second to John Montefusco in Rookie of the Year voting and was selected as an All-Star. Carter would be elected to the National League All-Star team 7 times during his tenure with Montreal and won 3 Gold Gloves. Gary Carter was a star. But age comes for us all. And even though Gary Carter was Gary Carter, the Expos saw a man who was about to turn 31 years old. And while that may be okay for an infielder or outfielder, playing catcher is not an old man's position. Carter was traded by the Montreal Expos to the New York Mets for Hubie Brooks, Mike Fitzgerald, Herm Winningham, and Floyd Yeomans. The problem for Montreal was that this quartet of gentlemen stacked one on top of the other did not measure up to one Gary Carter. When studying Expos lore, this bad decision ranks up there with Mars Company refusing to let their M&M's candy be featured in E.T. Montreal got the fuzzy end of the lollipop. As for the Mets, well, their decision to trade for Gary Carter changed their franchise forever. As Taylor Swift says, "Welcome to New York." If you grew up with cable television in your home in the 1980s, you probably had WOR-TV out of New York. WOR was the successor to Channel 9 and first went on the air in 1949 carrying news, local public affairs, and religious presentations. As cable and satellite-delivered television became popular, independent stations like WOR were being distributed for regional and national viewers. They became superstations. In 1979, WOR went out to cable and C-band satellite subscribers across the United States, joining WTBS in Atlanta, who carried the Braves, and WGN-TV in Chicago, who carried the Cubs, as national channels. Because of WOR's national broadcast, baseball fans across America were able to see Gary Carter play for the New York Mets and continue to terrorize the National League East as he had done with the Montreal Expos the previous 11 seasons. It's not often that a player the caliber of Gary Carter is traded within the same division. In his first season as a Met, Carter played like a madman. A 281 batting average, voted as an all-star and winner of the Catcher Silver Slugger Award. For the Mets' part, they did all they could do by winning 98 games in the regular season, but finished 3 games behind the St. Louis Cardinals, who had an otherworldly season, winning 101 games. When a team wins 98 games and doesn't get the pennant, it's like losing with 4 kings to a straight flush. It's a bad beat. But Carter, the Mets, and Mets fans would not be waiting long before claiming the Commissioner's Trophy for themselves. 1986 was a magical year for New York. In an absolute domination of the regular season, New York won 108 games, finishing 21.5 games ahead of the second-place Phillies. On September 17th, 1986, Dwight Gooden made his 30th start of the season for the Mets and led them to clinch the National League. New York rallied around the team and cheered them on to the World Series against the Boston Red Sox, who fielded eventual Hall of Fame players Wade Boggs and Jim Rice. On October 25th at Shea Stadium in New York, it was put up or shut up for the Mets. They were down 3-2 and in front of a sold-out crowd, who were yelling and stomping their feet for their hometown boys. Gary Carter came to the plate in the bottom of the 8th inning, with bases loaded and one out. Carter swung at a low fastball and hit a sacrifice fly to left, scoring Lee Mazzilli from third base. The Red Sox came back in the top of the 10th, scoring 2 runs and taking the air out of Shea. What was already a tense game now had fans reduced to puddles of anxious sweat. It is now the bottom of the 10th inning, and the Mets have one final shot to extend the series. Wally Backman leads off and flies out to left field on an 0-2 pitch. Keith Hernandez comes to the plate and flies out to deep center on a 2-1 breaking ball. Red Sox pitcher Calvin Schiraldi had thrown 5 pitches and was 1 out away from a Boston World Series title. Coming to the plate was Gary Carter, who tied the game in the 8th with a sacrifice fly to left. All eyes and hopes were on Carter as he settled into the batter's box. Gary Carter was there, and he had a purpose. He was dialed in. Bob Ojeda, teammate of Carter's and former Mets broadcaster, said of Carter's at-bat, "You look at that at-bat and they should show that to every high school kid, every rookie, everyone who was trying to be somebody. That was an at-bat for the ages. He was a guy who was determined to get a hit and not be the final out. The first pitch was up and popped foul by Carter. The second pitch was high and even the count at 1-1. Pitch number 3 was an outside breaking ball which Carter laid off. It was 2-1. With looks of worry and disappointment on the faces of Mets players in their dugout, Schiraldi threw an off-speed pitch that Carter lifted to left for a base hit. Following that, Kevin Mitchell singled to center field, moving Carter to second base. Ray Knight then singled to center, scoring Carter and moving Mitchell to third base. The Mets had gone from dead in the water to one swing away from a win. Mookie Wilson came to the plate but didn't need to do much as Mitchell scored on a wild pitch. Ray Knight scored on a dribbler up the first baseline that went through Bill Buckner's legs, one of the most famous plays in baseball history. The Mets won Game 6, and it was all thanks to the rally started by Carter on a 2-1 pitch with two outs. That at-bat was arguably Carter's most important of his career. The Mets would go on to win the 1986 World Series at Shea 2 nights later. While Carter was a showman in front of the camera, he was a quiet and reserved guy when he was not playing. Other players would go out on the town, and Carter would stay in his hotel and order room service. He was not someone who enjoyed certain spoils that came with being a professional athlete. One player in particular, Keith Hernandez, was the opposite of Carter. Keith was one who enjoyed being single and enjoyed living the life of a famous baseball player, as opposed to the family man and reserved Carter. The two respected one another for their talent and what each brought to the game, but, especially in Carter's case, he did not approve of the way Keith lived his life. This muted animosity came to a head when manager Davey Johnson named Keith as captain of the Mets. You could almost feel the heat coming from underneath Carter's blue cap. Davey delegated a lot of responsibility to Keith, so much that he was viewed by the press and other players as a co-manager. In Davey's mind, Keith had been in New York longer. He had more winning experience and really had brought that successful mindset from St. Louis. This did not sit well with Carter. He saw it as his contributions and success in Montreal being overlooked, and that, in a way, he was being punished for his quiet demeanor. But being raucous and extroverted was not Carter's way. He was not your garden variety big leaguer. In 86, 87, and 88, Carter was elected to the All-Star team. He was still the best catcher in the league, but after several surgeries, his knees could no longer provide the support he needed to keep playing at his accustomed high level. Because of his bad knees, 1988 was Carter's last full-time year, but he had one more surprise up his sleeve. Carter hit home run number 299 on May 16th against the Padres. Mets fans would shiver with anticipation for 255 more at-bats and nearly 3 months before Carter hit the historic round-tripper. August 11th, 1988, against the Chicago Cubs at Wrigley Field, Gary Carter hit his 300th home run off Al Nipper on a 2-2 curveball to left field. Nipper had pitched against the Mets in the 1986 World Series when he played for Boston. Nipper was more than tired of Gary Carter. In 1989, reality set in for Carter. He had played a career-low 50 games because of much-needed knee surgery. Carter's slash line for that year was 183, 241, 275, the lowest of his career. The Mets released him at the end of the season, and with that, the Gary Carter era ended in New York. But just because the bright lights of New York were in his rear view, that did not mean he was finished with baseball. He joined the San Francisco Giants as a free agent in January 1990. Carter was in a platoon with Terry Kennedy. Carter still wanted to play every day, though, and if he could not do that, he did not want to be there. Carter was a free agent at the end of that season, and in March of 91, he went to spring training for Tommy Lasorda's Dodgers, backing up Mike Socha. Carter came to the realization that he was no longer an everyday player. His body could not tolerate the abuse of catching day in and day out. Carter started in every game for 2 straight weeks, including a doubleheader against the Braves on June 28th, when Socha was out with a broken hand. In the twilight of his career, Gary Carter was a worker. At the end of 1991, the Dodgers placed Carter on waivers. He wondered if any team would take a flyer on a 38-year-old catcher with bubblegum for knees. One team did come calling. The Montreal Expos signed him to a 1-year contract. Carter was headed back to his beginning to finish his Major League story. Gary Carter was the Expos franchise in every way. As much as he was to Mets fans, he meant all that much and more to the Expos faithful. Gary Carter was Mr. Baseball in Montreal. In what was the final at-bat of his career on September 27th, the Expos were tied with the Cubs in the bottom of the 7th inning, and the kid delivered one final time. Carter was 0-2 that day, having grounded out in the 2nd inning and striking out looking in the 5th. Cubs pitcher Mike Morgan was 0-2 and threw a fastball right down Broadway. Carter drove it into right field. The ball took a high hop over Andre Dawson's head. Larry Walker scored from 2nd base, the only run of the game. The fans in the stands cheered for several minutes as Carter trotted into the dugout, being taken out of the game for a pinch runner. Everyone knew this was his last appearance, and the fans wanted to show all of his appreciation. Carter could not have asked for a much better way to cap off his career, especially wearing the uniform of a city who loved him for 20 years. Former teammate Keith Hernandez said, "He was a human backstop back there. Early, before his knees went bad, you couldn't steal on him in Montreal. When he wasn't able to throw because of his knees, that never affected his performance. He was running on and off the field after 3 outs. This guy played in some pain, and it was hustle, hustle, hustle." After the career he put together, Carter was a lock for Cooperstown in the minds of most, but that honor wouldn't come for 6 years. Finally, in 2003, the Baseball Writers Association of America finally got their act together and voted him in. Carter was on the golf course with friends when the call came letting him know of the vote. Carter said, "I'm thankful and grateful to be inducted. It doesn't matter what year you go in, as long as you go in." The Expos relocated to Washington, D.C. to become the Washington Nationals after the 2004 season, a banner displaying Carter's number along with those of Andre Dawson, Tim Raines, and Rusty Staub was hung from the rafters at the Bell Center, home of the NHL's Montreal Canadiens. While the Mets have not retired number 8, it has remained unused since Carter's election to the Hall of Fame. Carter was named Gulf Coast League and Florida State League Manager of the Year in 2005 and 2006. He won the Florida State League Championship in 2006 with the St. Lucie Mets. In 2008, Carter managed the Orange County Flyers to a championship in the Golden Baseball League. He was also named Manager of the Year that year. His story in this podcast episode would be perfect if it ended right here. And I'd love to be able to tell you that Gary Carter retired and spends his days on the beach playing with his grandkids, occasionally making appearances for charity or at New York Mets functions, but we all know that's not how it unfolded for the kid. In May of 2011, he began having problems with memory lapses and continual headaches. Carter visited his general practitioner and went through a battery of tests. It turned out Carter was suffering from a menacing and rare form of brain cancer, stage 4 glioblastoma multiforme. "The last time I saw him a couple months ago, he looked well. He was Gary," said former Mets teammate Mookie Wilson. "He seemed himself. No indication that anything was wrong. Whatever the situation may be, of course I wish him well. I hope things turn out for the best." Former teammate Ron Darling said, "It's so sad. He has great faith, great family, So he's got an entire roster of people that are going to help him through this. He's not called the kid for nothing, and we want him around for a long time. Tim McCarver, 1980s announcer for the Mets, said he immediately thought of Carter's bright smile. The ear-to-ear smile that only Gary has, and obviously a smile is very important at a time like this, McCarver said. I think everybody is kind of in that wait-and-see mode, but certainly he has occupied our thoughts since we heard the news. Doctors told Carter his tumors were inoperable. His physicians put together a treatment plan of radiation and chemotherapy. Gary fought his cancer with the same tenacity and grit he displayed on the diamond. Carter fought like hell for 10 months. But on February 16, 2012, Gary Carter died. I am deeply saddened to tell you that my precious dad went to be with Jesus today at 4:10 p.m. This is the most difficult thing I have ever had to write in my entire life, but I wanted you all to know, Carter's daughter, Kimmy Blomers, wrote on the family website. He is in heaven and has reunited with his mom and dad. I believe with all my heart that Dad has a standing ovation as he walked through the gates of heaven to be with Jesus, Blomers wrote. Gary spent 37 years married to his wife, Sandy. They had three children, Kimmy, DJ, and Christy. Fans from Montreal to New York, from Olympic to Shea Stadium, did and still do mourn the loss of one of the greatest players to ever don a catcher's mask. Gary Carter was a leader on a team of leaders. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Dead Ball Podcast. If you'd like to connect with like-minded baseball fans or learn more about the show, please find the Dead Ball Discussion Group on Facebook. We look forward to seeing you there.
It's a base hit. It's a 1-0.
You'll never hit a bigger home run in your life.
Fly ball deep left center. Grissom
ball game over.